Well, good evening, everybody. I'm Tony Giddens, the director of the LSE, at least for a few more weeks. I'm still the director of the LSE. I'd like to welcome you all to the first Hayek Memorial Lecture. F.A. Hayek has been one of the most influential social philosophers of the 20th century. His early works as an economist, developing a synthesis of von Mises' Austrian school theory of the business cycle and the Lausanne school theory of general equilibrium, earned him a chair at LSE, which he held from 1931 until 1950. At the LSE, Hayek pioneered the economic analysis of the role that information plays in coordinating the division of labor. He later developed a general social theory, stressing the importance of spontaneous orders and institutions, such as those which characterize a market economy. In 1947, Hayek founded the neoliberal Mont Pelerin Society, through which he was to have great personal and intellectual influence on virtually all post-war liberal and conservative movements, resulting in the radical Prices and Production lecture series and the famous Cambridge, Keynes versus LSE, Hayek-Robbins debates. I mean, I would have been on the Keynes side, but I'm probably not supposed to say that. Hayek was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1974 as a direct result of this LSE work. I'd particularly like to welcome Professor Roger Garrison here this evening. Professor Garrison is spending a month at the LSE as the school's first Hayek Fellow. He received his PhD from the University of Virginia. He is a professor of economics at Auburn University. Doesn't say so here, but you must be an LSE alumnus.
No.
Oh, well, he's wearing an LSE tie. It's the first, I mean, you're not allowed to if you're not an LSE alumnus.
I am now.
In 2001, he published Time and Money, The Macroeconomics of Capital Structure, published by Routledge Press. Professor Garrison has continued on from where Hayek and Robbins left off, pre-World War II, before the Keynesian hegemony took hold, and has thoroughly reformulated the Austrian theory of the business cycle, addressing the shortcomings, at least so it says here, of present-day Keynesian, neo-Keynesian, monetarist, and rational expectations, explanations of the current business cycle. Well, that's pretty heavy stuff if you've achieved all that. Before asking him to take the podium, can I just thank Toby Baxendale, through whose generosity this fellowship and lecture have been made possible. I'd like to thank Reggie Simpson from the Development Office, who's done an awful lot of work also making the occasion possible and helping organize it. And Tim Besley from the Institution of the LSE, which rejoices in the name of Stickard, which is impenetrable an outsider, but is all about social and economic development. Tim is one of the key figures in the school and has also played a major role in making this evening's event possible. So please give a very warm LSE welcome to Professor Garrison, who's title is up there, Hayek's Contribution to Economics. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Giddens. Let me start by saying that when I first heard that there may be an opportunity to spend a month at the LSE, I was hopeful and very enthusiastic. Then when it became a reality and that I would spend a month here, and that it would include even a lecture on Hayek's contributions to economics, I was more enthusiastic. And now I can report that my enthusiasm was only slightly diminished when I learned that the director scheduled this lecture on John Maynard Keynes' birthday. Born June the 5th in 1883, which would make this his 120th birthday. But you can't talk about Hayek without talking about Keynes. And I plan to talk some about Keynes, both in the fundamentalist mode, fundamentalist Keynesianism, which essentially denies that the market works, claims that there's a essential flaw, and the so-called hydraulic mode of Keynesian analysis, which indicates how markets do perform given the flaw. Now, if it's Keynes' birthday, it's also Adam Smith's birthday, at least according to many reputable accounts. Some purists say that Adam Smith was baptized on June the 5th and probably born a few days earlier. I don't know about that. Adam Smith would be 280 today, born in 1723. Now, while Hayek built on the work of Karl Menger and Eugen von Bombeberg and Ludwig von Mises, he did draw insights and got inspiration from Adam Smith and his invisible hand, which is the market process at work. Just for the record, Hayek was born on May the 8th, which was the day I began in earnest preparing this lecture. I've put on the screen for you Hayek's major appointments, beginning with the LSE, where he spent 20 years. And it was during that time that he produced what has come to be called his technical economics. I hesitate to use that term for two reasons. One is, it's not all that technical, as I hope to demonstrate this evening. And secondly, it's come to be used almost as a way of dismissing Hayek's early contribution. Technical economics is used in a dismissive sense. But that's the economics I'm going to focus on. His later work at the University of Chicago is more in political philosophy, as was his work at the University of Freiburg. I've noted here his Nobel Prize in 1974, and want to point out, that's a photo of Hayek in about 47, that's the year he founded the Mont Pelerin Society, years after he had made his contribution to industrial fluctuations, and years before he actually got the Nobel Prize for it. But I'd like to point out that the prize was granted, largely, or at least in a first mention sense, for his work in business cycle theory. So he was awarded the prize for pioneering work in the theory of money and economic fluctuations, and for penetrating analysis of the interdependence of economic, social, and institutional phenomena. Many Hayek scholars today see all those parts after that "and" as constituting a break in Hayek's work from the early technical work to political philosophy, which was in some sense at odds with the early work. My own judgment is different, that that the two are made of the same cloth, that his business cycle theory is actually an application of some of the political philosophy that he later went on to articulate. Now, his specific contributions in economics were in several fields, in capital theory, in monetary theory, in basic price theory, the role of prices as conveyors of knowledge, his 1937 article, for instance. But what I find it useful to do, and wholly justifiable, is to show the one theory that he developed that incorporates all the above. It incorporates all those different facets and comes together in an Austrian theory of the business cycle, sometimes called the Hayekian theory of the business cycle, actually has its roots in the work of Ludwig von Mises, who was Hayek's mentor. Mises first articulated the theory in an early book, 1912, Theory of Money and Credit, and I call your attention here to the strikingly classical tone of the way he set out the problem. The period of production, Mises says, must be of such a length that exactly the whole available subsistence fund is necessary on the one hand and sufficient on the other for paying the wages of the labor throughout the duration of the productive process. Now, that's very classical terms, mentioning the subsistence fund and the period of production as it does. Mises went on to develop the theory in terms of Bombeberg's capital theory. But even in this classical statement on the screen, you can see the seeds of a business cycle theory. In other words, suppose the period of production is too long, such the subsistence fund is not great enough to sustain the workers and other factors of production through to completion, then there's likely to be a crisis of some kind, a downturn that we'd identify as a cyclical downturn. That's what Hayek had to work with. I've read arguments that Hayek in his later years abandon the Austrian theory of the business cycle, turned more towards monetarism, and kept writing instead in political philosophy. My own view is something different, and in fact I have evidence from Hayek himself that he endorsed the Austrian theory even in his retirement years. In the late 70s, Hayek was in California for an extended period, and during that period he submitted to a number of interviews conducted at University of California at Los Angeles. UCLA had an oral history program, interviewed him a number of times, and including questions about the business cycle. And here he says very clearly his view as it still stood in the late 70s. This is Hayek in retirement here. Booms have always appeared with a great increase in investment, a large part of which proved to be erroneous, mistaken. That, of course, suggests that the supply of capital was made apparent, which wasn't actually existing. Well, okay, a little cryptic. We'll find out what that means later in this sequence of slides. The whole combination of the stimulus to invest on a large scale followed by a period of acute scarcity of capital is consistent with the idea that there has been misdirection due to monetary influences. And he says, in that general schema, I still believe is correct. Now, going on at that same time, the late 70s, when Hayek was at the Institute for Humane Studies, that's in the Bay Area in California, and I had the privilege of being in residence at IHS at this during the same period. There was a UCLA graduate, Gerald O'Driscoll, just putting the finishing touches on a book, reviving some of Hayek's ideas. It was called Economics as a Coordination Problem, the contribution of F.A. Hayek. Hayek read it, was enthusiastic about it, and he wrote the foreword to that book. Let me treat you now to a small snippet from the foreword that caught my attention at the time. Hayek says that it seems in principle possible to recast a great part of my economic theory in terms of the approach which I found useful in dealing with such different problems as those of industrial fluctuations and the running of a socialist economy is gratifying to me. He goes on and says, Professor O'Driscoll has almost persuaded me that I ought to have continued with the work I had been doing in the 1930s and 40s rather than let myself get drawn away to other problems which I felt to be more important. I have a feeling what Hayek had in mind here was dealing with Keynes, dealing with the general theory. Hayek never reviewed the general theory. He came to lament that, and I think this statement is a hint of that feeling on his part. But importantly to me, it shows that in Hayek's view, he was persuaded by O'Driscoll that yes, his thought had a common thread that ran through both his business cycle theory and his later theory in political philosophy. And he said it almost persuaded him. Well, it did persuade me to take up the issues of Keynes and Hayek to see what it was all about and to see what could be done in the way of putting Hayek and Keynes head to head, which really had never been done. They reviewed one another's books with some fairly hostile vitriolic reviews, but never actually came head to head and sorted out the differences, and I hope to do that in part at least for you this evening. One of the most basic distinctions between Keynes and Hayek has to do with their respective visions, and I'm hesitant to use that term if only because of its being cheapened in American political rhetoric. But it was used by Schumpeter. He called it a pre-analytic vision, which suggests that there is some analysis to follow. So I'm using it in that Schumpeterian sense as a pre-analytic vision. The vision adopted by Hayek was one that reflect Adam Smith, reflect also Karl Menger, that the economic system is a spontaneous order, that it takes care of itself, that it has equilibrating tendencies, but that it's vulnerable to disruption, and particularly in the monetary sphere, which particularly means the interest rate, it means the quality of saving investment, and all that. That was Hayek's vision. And out of that vision came a methodological maxim. And that is, I think I've got it stated here, before we can meaningfully ask what might go wrong, we should first understand how things could go right. It just seemed like bedrock methodology to Hayek to begin that way. We'll contrast that with Keynes shortly. But let me give you a hint of what Hayek had in mind here. We're going to begin getting graphical on you. And put up a set of axes where I'm looking at consumer spending, looking at consumption on the vertical axis, investment on the horizontal axis. And recognizing that at some level, there's a trade-off between those two. Resources allocated in one direction can't be allocated in the other. And of course, we represent that trade-off conventionally as a production possibilities frontier, which I'm willing to do here this evening. There's a production possibilities frontier. This is a graph that Hayek used very rarely, mainly in his discussion of theory of interest. But I've found it useful in understanding his business cycle theory and his macroeconomics generally. So I've reintroduced it in a slightly different framework. Production possibilities frontier. Now, of course, if the economy is going right, as he suggests here, then the economy is going to be somewhere on that frontier, which we would identify as full employment. And I'm using that term in a macroeconomically relevant sense. In other words, it's employment that maybe allows for 5% frictional employment. Okay, it's not 100% full. It allows for the standard frictions in the economy, which suggests that the economy can push beyond that, but not far. Okay, so that's full employment. Of course, Keynes thought it was a normal state of affairs for the economy to be inside that production possibilities frontier. Hayek would have considered that a disequilibrium level of output of consumer goods and investment goods. And in the way I've constructed it, it's also possible, even in real terms, to be beyond the frontier. It just means that those levels aren't sustainable. The PPF itself is defined in terms of sustainable levels of consumption and investment. Normally, they would be on the frontier. Okay? Now, key to understanding Hayek and understanding the difference between his theory and Keynes is that second P in PPF, production possibilities frontier. Even to use that technique is to suggest that it ought to be possible for the economy to move along that frontier somehow. It ought to be possible for increased savings to give rise to more investment and less consumption. It ought to be possible for people to switch in the direction of consumption, making do with less investment, okay? So the key question, is it possible for that point to move along the frontier, okay? Well, let's see. It looks like it is, okay? It's possible. I know, Hayek still has some work to do to figuring out how it's possible, how does the market actually do that, but we'll come to that. If we contrast that with Keynes, and I'll bring in Keynes with that same production possibilities frontier, he effectively denied that possibility. He denied the second P in the PPF, and he did it most dramatically, although probably not most relevantly for his own scheme of thought. He did it with the paradox of thrift. Look at this statement, short, pithy statement. Every attempt to save more by reducing consumption will so affect incomes that the attempt necessarily defeats itself. A very strong statement, necessarily defeats itself, okay? So save more, you don't get more investment, you simply get less income out of which to save. You've all heard the stories. You save, you're not spending. If you're not spending, inventories accumulate. Firms cut back on production. They lay off workers, income goes down, saving goes down, consumption goes down, everything goes down. So saving has a way of putting the economy in into depression. And by the way, this idea, though not all that important in Keynes, as I'll suggest in a minute, certainly has currency in today's debates. Just yesterday in the Wall Street Journal, Robert McTeer, who is president of the Dallas Fed, had an article in which he worried about the paradox of thrift. He named it the paradox of thrift. He had a picture of Keynes along with it, and he wrote that Maynard Keynes's paradox of thrift is currently relevant. If all or many consumers start trying to save more, the economy will be in deep trouble. Okay, that's the president of the Federal Reserve Bank at Dallas. And so let's look at Keynes's alternative vision. See, there's a vision difference here. Hayek thought that Keynes was simply flouting the important methodological maxim. Keynes hadn't shown how the economy could work right before he set out to show what might go wrong. The fact is, going right was no part of Keynes' vision. Keynes' vision is that the economy is inherently flawed. Okay, it works wrong and has to be put right by stabilization policy of one sort or another. So let's look at our movement. Possible movements are inside the frontier if people save more, and it can be moved back only by fiscal and monetary policy wisely designed. In Keynes's defense, I'll say that this is not something he worried about too much because he didn't think people did change their saving habits. He thought that much more likely there would be a sudden and unexpected collapse in investment demand, and that's what would send the economy into depression. But still the same, it would have to be put back on the frontier with stimulant policies of one sort or another. Now, he does say near the end of his book that once full employment is reached, then the classical theory comes into its own. But if we think about that, we realize it can't mean that now people can save and give rise to more investment, because we've just seen, according to the paradox of thrift, that savings will take us inside the frontier. And in fact, if there's an increase in consumer spending or any kind of spending at this point, it doesn't take us along the frontier in the other direction, but rather beyond the frontier. Okay, so it goes beyond the frontier like that. Abba Lerner, who was one of the early and lifelong Keynesians, actually identified this feature as the key difference between Keynes and Hayek. That Hayek thought investment and consumption could move opposite one another, okay, along the frontier, where Keynes thought they always moved in the same direction, in the frontier and outside the frontier. And Lerner even said at the time that he thought maybe Keynes didn't understand just how revolutionary his theory was. Well, I think Keynes did understand. He did understand how revolutionary it was. He knew it had to be patched up continuously with stabilization policies. That was the hydraulic Keynesianism. But he wanted to do that only long enough until more meaningful social reforms could be put in place, reforms that were all aimed at taking investment decisions out of the private sector. Okay, so that's the fundamentalist Keynesian. Now, Hayek has set about to explain just how it is that the market moves along the frontier, and he initially did it in the early 30s when he first came to lecture at LSE using a little graphical device that's called a Hayekian triangle. You'll see it in a minute. But he soon became dissatisfied with it. He thought it was too simple. And he went on to build models that were much more complex. In fact, he spent much of his time at LSE writing The Pure Theory of Capital. First 10 years he was here, it wasn't published until 1941. And The Pure Theory of Capital was a very complex, very imponderable, almost unreadable book with graphics to go with it to show just how the economy actually does work in order to move you along the frontier. The students didn't warm up to it. Quoting one of the students, recalls that the three-dimensional diagrams with which Hayek presented his ideas made them seem like something from the field of engineering. And just in case you doubt the student's judgment, that's the kind of graphs that eventually found their way into The Pure Theory of Capital. that shows supposedly the intertemporal capital structure. I won't explain it in detail. What I'll say instead is that Hayek would have been much better off had he gone back to his simpler formulation in 1931, which was the Hayekian triangle. And it looks something like that. What this triangle does is keeps track of the time dimension in the production process, all right? And it does it by suggesting that production takes place in a sequence of stages of production. Time is measured left to right along the horizontal axis, and at the end of that process, there's an output of consumer goods, a consumable output, all right? So one stage feeds into another. I've shown about five stages here. It's variable under different credit conditions. It can be lengthened or shortened. It has a very Bombeverkian flavor to it. The slope of the hypotenuse of that triangle reflects the rate of return on real assets. Okay, in other words, it suggests that the ratio of output prices to input prices for any given stage will be consistent with the rate of interest in financial markets. That's part of the equilibrium mechanisms. To bring this thing to life, let me show you, let me apply it to any given industry. We could take one at random, take the pork industry, and watch the goods process through the stages of production. You could start out with building a pig pen, raising the pigs, sending them to the slaughterhouse, then to packaging, then to retail, till you eventually get your output, okay? That's the Hayekian triangle at work for you and for me, okay? Now, at any given time, there exist resources allocated to these stages simultaneously so that we can shift resources from late stages to early stages and change the pattern of consumable output emerging at the end. We'll see more about that later. Here I'm paraphrasing Hayek. And he says, we must begin our analysis with a properly functioning market economy. It sounds like a British way of saying it, actually, the properly functioning part. But he said general equilibrium, which was much too strong even at the time, but certainly much too strong in today's profession. He simply meant that we need to start our analysis with the economy working right, with without the problems whose origins we're attempting to explain. And he relied to a great extent on the loanable funds market, which has an honorable history and existed mainly in the hands of Dennis Robertson in British economics. The loanable funds market simply indicates that there are savers out there and there are investors, and the interest rate adjusts to bring the two in line with one another. Savings has an upward slope to it. People respond to incentives. The more they're paid to save, the more they save. Demand for loanable funds has a downward slope to it. People are more inclined to invest, borrow the funds, and undertake projects of one sort or another if they can borrow the money cheaply. And that market clears at some rate of interest. Now, Bombeverk and Keynes both recognize this market as being better described as the market for investable resources. And that's what it is. It's the market for the part of current output that's currently produced but not used for consumption. Output that can then be used to increase the investment in the economy. I might mention at this point that this graph, loanable funds market, is the one and only graph that appears in the general theory. If you flip through that general theory, you don't see any graphs except this one. It's on page 180. He put it in at Roy Herod's suggestion, and only to say that this is what he's throwing out. Okay, this is the part of the market mechanism that Keynes says does not work. Now, all we have to do is bring in our production possibilities frontier, and we've got everything lined up. In other words, it shows how a market could work if it's working right. That is, look at investment in the loanable funds market. Assume the economy is at full employment. That tells you how much consumption can be produced. And that level of consumption lines up with the Hayekian triangle to show its relationship with the stages of production that went before it. Okay? Now, the simplest interpretation here, because you see you've got an economy working right, but it's just sitting there, and yet there's some investment going on. What's happening to the investment? Well, if we simply assume that that level of investment is exactly equal to capital depreciation, so that there's no net investment, then the economy just sits there in that format, okay, that that the current investment is simply used to keep all the parts working, to replace worn out machinery and so on. The only thing I haven't shown here is a labor market, and Hayek did not discuss labor in terms of the labor market. In fact, he made a point that labor markets in different stages work differently, and we need to show an early stage labor market and a late stage labor market, which I've done here. Let's see, I'm setting up the equilibrium, supply and demand for loanable funds, and the PPF, rate of return in the production, or in the Hayekian triangle, and I look at a couple of labor markets for an early stage and a late stage and show that they're both in supply and demand equilibrium. So there's the basic framework that Hayek had in mind when he was saying that we have to start with an economy properly working. Now, one extension here is to imagine that this level of investment actually entails some net investment. That is, it's greater than depreciation. Suppose depreciation, I'll put some numbers on it here. Suppose depreciation is something less than the current level of investment. That means the difference is net investment and the economy can grow, all right? Which means the production possibilities frontier will shift outward, resources will be allocated proportionally to all the different stages of production, and both the supply and the demand for investment funds will grow with the growing economy, okay? So let's watch the economy grow. You can hear the economy grow. Okay, it grows. Okay. One of Hayek's arguments was that Keynes had a level of aggregation that covered up the critical market mechanisms. And he pointed this out originally in a review of Treatise on Money, where Hayek had argued in terms of average profits. Keynes had argued in terms of average profits. Hayek pointed out that the economy is not moved by average profits, it's moved by differential profits. The resources leave areas that have low profits and go into areas that have high profits, even though the average may not change. And that can be illustrated in terms of the little framework I have here quite handily. Suppose, for instance, that people decide to save more. It's a rightward shift in the saving function in the loanable funds market. I feel like I almost have to explain why people might want to save more, because Keynes claimed people don't want to save more. But in the name of time, I'm going to pass over that. They're saving for retirement, or they're saving for down payment on a house, or for travel, or whatever. Okay, they decide they want to save more. Clearly, that lowers the interest rate and gives an incentive for investors to invest more. If we look at that in the production possibilities frame, what we see is that can move the economy along the production possibilities frontier in the direction of more investment and less consumption. Saving more means consuming less, freeing up resources to be used for investment. If we look at the Hayekian triangle, we see a differential effect. We see that in the late stages of production, there's a decrease in demand. If people really aren't consuming as much now, they're not buying as much from retail stores, then there's less demand to have products there right now ready for them. At the same time, at the other end of the structure, there's an increase in demand because of the low interest rate. Long-term projects tend to look relatively profitable if borrowing rates are sufficiently low. And the effect of that, of course, is to change the slope of that triangle, changes the rate of return, allocates resources from late stages to early stages, and notice that the shape of the triangle has a slope now that reflects the lower rate of interest in the loanable funds market, and you can see it in the market for labor as well. You can predict the way the changes are going to be. There can be less demand for labor in the late stages and more in the early stages. Okay? I clean up the diagram. and make it happen all at once for you. I showed it step at a time, to watch the economy adjust, to increase savings without there being a paradox that Keynes thought existed. So watch the economy, listen to it, see if it grows smoothly. There it is, okay, it grows. It grows. And you notice that current consumption is actually lower than it was before. But that's what savings is all about. People save up for something. They reduce consumption in the current period in order to be able to save more or to spend more in some future period. So now watch the economy grow, all right? And you'll see it grow at a higher rate. Okay, it grows at a higher rate because you've got more investment to start with. I'll put a frame in here that even shows you the comparison that before the increase in saving, the economy would grow at one rate, and after the increase in saving, it would grow at a higher rate, so that in this illustration, after just three periods, people are actually consuming more than they would have had they not initially saved. I might say here that Hayek was no growth hawk, as that term is being used in American politics. He wasn't trying to get people to save more or recommending policies to get people to save more. He was just pointing out that the economy will grow in relationship to your willingness to save. If you're willing to save a little, it'll grow a little. If you're willing to save a lot, it will grow a lot. That was his message. Okay, now we come to the business cycle part. See, a lot of this, it's a setup. It shows you what the market mechanisms are in the economy that can get distorted by monetary influences. And now we're ready to show that distortion. And here I draw from two different places in Hayek. He says, money by its very nature constitutes a kind of loose joint in a self-equilibrating apparatus of the price mechanism. This is from the final part of Pure Theory of Capital, where he did get around to criticizing Keynes. And closest he came to reviewing Keynes was in these waning pages of the Pure Theory, where he pointed out that Keynes treated money as if it were a broken joint. No, it's not broken, it's just loose. But that's no justification for playing around with the loose joint, okay? And loose though it is, the market still works, although maybe not quite as smoothly as in the earlier slides. He goes on to say that the task of monetary theory is nothing less than to cover for a second time the whole field which is treated by the pure theory under the assumption of barter. Hayek sometimes made statements that were a little stronger than he needed. He didn't really mean literally barter. He simply meant an economy where money wasn't causing trouble, okay? It's an economy where money is being used as a medium of exchange, but its looseness is not a problem. It's not being manipulated, okay? There's no trouble coming from money. And now we have to treat it where there is trouble coming from money. He made a first-order distinction that plays very well in his later work, where the spontaneous order works fine if you have a system of individuals each pursuing their own goals and not trying to rig the system in some way, okay? But if you have a central planner or a central monetary authority who is in the picture and has motives of his own, such as possibly making the interest rate something other than what people in the loanable funds market would actually make it, then you're going to get a different story. So Hayek's idea here is to analyze what goes on if there is some extra market agent in the picture, okay? I won't name names, okay? But you could have an extra market agent who had goals of his own of what to do with the economy. He might want to grow the economy, and I would say that the economics of that are as bad as the syntax, okay? Grow should be an intransitive verb when applied to an economy and not transitive. But suppose he wants to grow the economy, shifting the supply of loanable funds, not really increasing saving, but just padding the supply of loanable funds with money created for the purpose, all right? That doesn't create a new equilibrium, it creates a double disequilibrium. What it does is drives a wedge between saving and investment. It causes investors to have the incentive to invest more. They want to borrow at the low rate, but savers have an incentive to save less because they're only getting the low rate. All right? The difference being the wedge. Analytically, this would be equivalent to putting a credit cap on that market. Well, if that's all you did, it would create an instant shortage of credit, wouldn't it? But putting a credit cap on that market and then papering over the shortage with new money created for the occasion. All right? That wouldn't exactly solve the problem, but rather would let it fester for a while until the problem eventually turned into a crisis and a downturn. In other words, slap on a credit cap and you get a credit crunch, a crisis immediately. But expand the money supply through credit markets and you get an artificial boom followed by a bust. That's Hayek's story. If we follow this on up in the production possibility frame, what we see that the wedge in the lower diagram shows up as a tug of war in the upper diagram. In other words, consumers are trying to pull in one direction, investors are trying to pull in the other. And for a time, they can both pull because money is a loose joint. It overheats the economy. It takes the economy into the unsustainable range. It drives employment down from its natural rate of 5 to 6%, as low as 3.9%, which the U.S. experienced 3 or 4 years ago. Okay, so we see in consumers and investors pulling in opposite directions. We see both successful for a time. So the economy is overheated. It's producing at a level that's unsustainable. Something has got to give. Okay, and yet this policy is pursued on a number of occasions, largely because it's politically popular. Okay, it has political appeal. Hayek was an important precursor of political business cycle theory. The administration is likely to be there taking credit for the increase in output. Okay, that's the story. I think you're getting the story, okay? If we look at this in terms of the Hayekian triangle, what we see is that here we had a wedge, then a tug of war. Now we see that the triangle is being pulled at both ends against the middle. Mises has the better expression for this than Hayek. He called it malinvestment and overconsumption. In other words, there are two effects going on. One is the derived demand effect. If people are trying to consume more now, entrepreneurs are there to try to meet that demand and make profits at it. At the same time, if interest rates are low, people are trying to take advantage of low interest rates by investing in long-term projects. And the resources are coming from the middle of the stages. So you have the triangle being pulled at both ends against the middle at the same time, growing at an unsustainable rate. Okay, the net result of that looks something like that. In other words, you have a discoordinated capital structure. Capital is misallocated, and doubly so, by conflicting signals in terms of consumer demand and low interest rates. You can see the crisis in the making. In fact, if we could think back to Mises' subsistence fund argument, you can see that as this economy moves forward, that the goods in process in the middling stages are going to emerge as lower levels of consumable output than is currently being satisfied. That's the downturn, right? And the downturn can take a life of its own, can take the economy inside the frontier much further than the disruption would suggest. In other words, you can get a secondary contraction where the economy caves into depression. So if you look at the PPF, in fact, what I want to do now is just gray out some of those graphs, because too much is going on. There's distressed borrowing going on, people trying to finish projects they wish they hadn't started. Even Milton Friedman recognized that effect. There is loss of confidence in the economy, not just an unexplained loss of confidence, but a very understandable loss. There is scramble for liquidity, not because people have a fetish for liquidity, but because uncertainty about how this is going to play itself out cause people to want to get out of the market and see what happens, okay? And so what you would expect to see is the economy push beyond the frontier towards that unsustainable point, but with a strong investment bias because the interest rate is low and business gets the new money first, and they borrow it through credit markets, and then the economy caves into depression as liquidation begins and so on. So it goes something like this, okay? Interesting at this point that Hayek identified that falling in the Deep Depression as a secondary depression, meaning that that's how things can take on a life of their own, get out of hand after the economy tries to adjust to the distortion of interest rates. Whereas Keynes would see the same movement and identify it as the fundamental flaw in a market system, all right? So if Keynes were looking at this same diagram, he would see the economy was initially at full employment equilibrium, and then somehow, for some reason, maybe the investment sector lost confidence, waning of animal spirits, or whatever, it fell into depression. Okay, Keynes had no capital theory in his general theory, and so couldn't track the same kind of a process that Hayek did. Okay, once more I clean up the diagram and let you watch a business cycle happen all at once. Okay, are you ready? Okay, nothing left to do but survey the damage. It's interesting. It's interesting, when I first put this file together back in 99, I had Clinton still at the helm when the crash came, but Austrian theory doesn't predict the timing of the downturn, it only predicts its inevitability, okay? So it's only to figure out what's going to happen here. All right, Curious George, you got it. And what to do? What to do? It's a catch-22 situation here. If you look at current debate, Greenspan gives high marks by Robert Teeter of the Dallas Fed. Of course, Greenspan is his boss, so I guess we have to take that into account. But Greenspan is in a catch-22 kind of a situation, that if he doesn't keep interest rates low, then the economy might slide into a secondary deflation that Hayek told us about. If he does keep interest rates low, then that postpones the liquidation that's needed, and it even uses up more resources by stimulating consumption, which is what's going on now. Either way, he loses. At best, he has the ability to trade depth for duration. If he wants to avoid a sharp downturn like we had in 1921, from which the economy covered quite quickly, he can keep those interest rates down, but in the process is likely to create a situation like Japan has now and has had for years. So once the damage has been done, once, and this is Hayek's point, this is one reason why Hayek lost out, by the way, because when the analytics are understood, you see that you get to this point in the cycle and there's no quick fix. There's no quick fix. It's damage control, and you can take your lumps in terms of a sharp downturn and stiff recovery, or a long period of liquidation, which is what, which is a choice that seems to be made. Nobody's laughing at this, well, except maybe glad he didn't win that election. Okay. This final part doesn't need much narration. It's got a lesson in syntax and a lesson in economics. Don't grow the economy. Just let the economy grow, okay? Hayek lost out to Keynes in the 1930s. Right now, though, there's a small army, well, a platoon, maybe, of economists in the U.S. and other countries trying to bring Hayek back. One of the groups doing it is the Mises Institute, which is instrumental in this program. Another is the Society for the Development of Austrian economics, which has a good toehold on the Southern Economic Society. And I'll invite you to visit my own website for other links and for more information about Hayek and his technical economics. Thank you very much.
We've got a few minutes for questions and observations, should anyone care to make them. And there are wandering mics both on the bottom tier and the top tier, so I invite questions from the audience. Yeah, neo-Keynesians and whoever.
Ian Johnson, LSE. 68. I was then from sociology, so I was in economics.
Can you hold the mic consistently?
two questions. One, I've never heard anybody talk about economics recently without mentioning technology. You haven't mentioned technology and how it might change economics. And two, I don't see how that you can change the economy without change the actual society behind it.
Well, let me try the first question, at least because it's important. It's an important factor in the story that I was telling in two episodes in U.S. history. I'll remind you that in the U.S., during the boom from 96 to 2000 or so, the strong belief was that we'd had such an increase in such a technological advance, mainly digital revolution, increased productivity of labor, and it had even ushered in a so-called new economy. I found that very worrisome because it sounds so similar to what Irving Fisher claimed in the 1920s. He called it a new plateau of prosperity. What I see happening in both cases, but let me focus on the latter case, is that the effects of the technological advance were allowing the monetary expansion not to show up in terms of inflation. One of the things that's common to both the 20s and the 90s is we had very, very low inflation, almost non-existent in the 20s and in the low single digits in the 90s. Which caused a lot of macroeconomists, certainly the monetarists and many others, to give the economy a good bill of health and to say that that the Fed was doing just right. But Hayek himself, in the early 20s, when he visited the United States, studied at New York University, watched what the Fed was doing, watched the price level that wasn't changing, warned about the coming collapse, referring to the system at the time as a policy of, he called it artificial price level stabilization, a term that would sound preposterous to most modern macroeconomists. But what he's saying there is that if you have a period where you do have technological advance and real economic growth, and you certainly did in the 20s, you certainly did in the 90s, then that's probably the time when monetary expansion is the most dangerous, because the absence of inflation gives the illusion of macroeconomic health, when in fact during the whole period the interest rate is artificially low and resources are being misallocated in precisely the ways that the Austrian theory predicts. So both of those periods, which I think are the two most significant periods, the 90s if only because they were the most recent, of the whole 20th century history, give precedence to the Austrian theory to explain what's going wrong, and not to the other macroeconomists who typically look at price level changes and inflation as a sign of a problem. Okay, there's a second question I'm not sure I had an answer to, so. Oh, no, not at all. In fact, I try to make the, if you're suggesting that
that I want people to save more. No, no, I don't want that. I just want people to recognize that the growth of the economy will be governed by how much they do save. But the change that's needed, I think, and this we see in Hayek, is simply of getting a central bank into control. And of course, Hayek, in his late years, actually argued in the direction of decentralizing the money supply process in order to take control out of the hands of a single individual. So that's not so much changing people's psychology, but rather removing the central element that's causing the problem.
Thank you.
What do you think about some of the radical measures being proposed by the Fed now in regards to, for example, pegging long-term interest rates, dropping money from a helicopter, all sorts of things like that? Actually, there's a paper from the Dallas Fed that came out a couple weeks ago, which actually has a picture of a helicopter on it. I'm not kidding. But what do you think? Do you think that's going to work? Do you think, I don't think you think it works, but maybe you can comment on that.
Well, I think the Fed, despite what they say, is about at the end of their rope as far as what they can do. That if you think of what they're doing now, they've got the federal funds rate down to 1.25%. They've got the discount rate down to 0.75%. Greenspan has mentioned targeting the long-term bond market. But if you stop to think about how you do that, you do it by buying long-term bonds and buying them with funds that didn't exist before you made the purchase, and those funds become reserves that are swapped around by the bank. So you're still forcing down the loanable funds market rate, all right? How much lower than 1.25% they can force it? I don't think much. The one thing they have discussed that probably is more worrisome because it's something they could do, hasn't been discussed much though, and that is that the discount rate, which is the lowest, of course, it's 0.75%. But there's not much of a volume of lending there. It's because it's lending only for very limited purposes, to make up reserve deficiencies and to deal with problem banks. But the Fed could begin lending freely in the discount window, lending to banks to borrow for whatever reason. They would be borrowing as long as they thought they could lend at greater than 0.75%. Okay. So that would be a way of pumping lots of money in the economy. I think that would be a worrisome thing. I think that Ben Bernanke is pushing in that direction. He's the one that, or in some direction, to lend more money into the system. And I'd say two things about it. One is that it would certainly continue the problem of postponing the adjustments that are needed. In other words, you're still, even if it works to trade depth for duration, all right? And worse yet, even if it works, it creates another problem down the line of pulling all that money out of the system if the economy does recover. And that's something I have very little confidence in the bank doing. It's always pretty easy to get money in. It's harder politically to pull it out. Okay, so I would worry about that phase.
Please. Do you want to get the mic, because then people in the top tier can hear you, if you hold it in the right position?
How's that? Is that in the right position?
Yeah, not bad. Fairly professional. Yeah.
There are two different paradigms though, that are going on in the world. You talk about the U.S. and Japan, and the policy prescription, I guess, that you're suggesting is that the outlook at the moment is wrong, and what we should see is an increase in rates to increase saving, which will increase consumption and make the world right, which is fine. Taking what looks like a fixed moment in time. Because the other paradigm that's gone on in the world is with interest rates at a higher level, which is in Europe, where real interest rates, given the recent increase in the rate of the euro, has tightened considerably. So is the scenario that we need to work at, given a Hayekian view of the world, is that European rates should fall and American rates should rise, or should European rates also rise, and should Japanese rates rise? Is that mm-hmm. the prescription?
Well, I'm not sure I can give a direct answer to that. I know that many economists, especially in connection with Japan, are literally recommending inflation in order to give them more scope for lowering real rates of interest. I don't think it's a good solution for Japan and nor for the United States. What I think is important to do is get market rates back at a level that's consistent with sustainable output. And I think to do that, you have to take your lumps. In other words, to me, a good guide to go by is look back at the downturn in 1921, when we had a very sharp downturn and some liquidation that took place very quickly because of relatively high interest rates, and an economy that recovered quite nicely and in a period of a year to a year and a half. Okay. Now, you're not seeing that in this episode because those rates aren't allowed to rise. And in fact, consumer spending is being stimulated, which eats up more resources that you actually need to straighten out the economy. All right. So again, it's a policy of trading depth for duration, and I think that's a losing policy.
Got someone from the top tier like to?
Michael Gilbert, LSE retired. The story I was given about Keynes was that during the 30s, the economy had reached a state of slump which persisted. The economic policymakers in charge at the time said that the problem was that we should wait for markets to clear, and the reason markets weren't clearing was because labor would refuse to reduce the price of what it was offering. And we just sat there for a period of time, which was more than a couple of years, with a lot of people in distress. Now, Keynes argued, as you say, that this was due to a fundamental flaw and that there needs to be stimulation to get matters right. And ultimately, that came with a war. Now, your argument, presumably, is that Hayek's argument is that was due to some mispolicy decisions. Is that just that interest rates were held too low by a central bank? Or is there another reason for why those slumpy conditions persisted, with apparently a balance in the economy being held far, far below your production policies frontier?
Specifically, the Hayekian diagnosis was those rates were held too low during the boom, okay, creating an excessive boom that gave you the depression. Now, let me answer as applied to the U.S., simply because I know more about that economy than this one. But Hayek would not have endorsed the kind of monetary blundering that went on after. In other words, the money supply was allowed to collapse after the crash, which made the situation much worse than it otherwise would have been. Hayek would have identified that problem as a secondary contraction and very unfortunate thing and so on. Not at all necessary in order for the economy to recover. But his major diagnosis was the problems that developed during the boom.
After a little reluctance, we now got lots of people want to ask questions. So over the back there first.
Change the batteries.
Hello. Hi. I'm the former chairman of Hayek Society in LSE, and Professor, I find your lecture very stimulating. Can you elaborate a bit more on the relation between Hayek's business cycle theory, with his theory on monetary theory, i.e. he wrote a book on denationalization of money. Apparently, in your lecture, the key element is that monetary authority cannot be trusted to set the interest rate. Therefore, Hayek somehow advocated before that the interest rate should be set free by market. Can you elaborate a bit more on that?
Well, I can say that it was late in Hayek's career, about 1974, when he first came out with Choice in Currency, followed shortly by Denationalization of Money. The first book is the better book, the Choice in Currency. And this was a period in which inflation was substantial and got worse, you know, in the coming years. Hayek attributed the problem, here he was, fell in line with the monetarists, the problem with inflation was excessive monetary creation. And in the absence of being able to rein in the central banking authority, the solution should be to take that power out of their hands. Hayek himself said he introduced the idea as something of a bitter joke, called it a bitter joke. He was just fed up with the behavior of the central banks. He wanted to take the authority out of their hands. But then he considered it as an intellectual puzzle that was interesting to work out. What happens if the supply of money is left to the free play of the marketplace? And of course, he's part now of a whole literature. There's a growing literature on decentralized money supply that has its roots, in part at least, in Hayek.
Please, you want to bring the mic down the front, please. Thank you.
thank you, Professor. I never heard you mention the word taxes, and I wonder if this is a preoccupation with both our political parties and their economists, whether, in fact, lower taxes would be approved of by Keynes, since it would allow people to have more disposable income to spend on consumer goods, and it would also be approved of by Hayek, because people would have more income to save.
Okay, thank you. I might say that in my book, I devote a whole chapter to fiscal policy, but didn't present any of that here. Of course, the kind of policies being advocated by or being passed right now by President Bush are very Keynesian in their flavor and explicitly so. It's a stimulant package, so-called. Hayek, of course, would favor a scaling down government, both on the taxing side and the government spending side. I suspect he would be leery of a tax cut that left government spending the same or rising, because that's really just making the appropriations of funds more cryptic. You know, we're going to get the funds, we're not telling you how, we're not going to get them in taxes, but some other way. And that tends to dampen economic activity. So I suspect that the current policy being pursued, which is going to entail deficits upwards of $500 billion in the U.S., is as likely to put a damper on the economy as to help it, because there's already plenty of uncertainty in the economy. And trying to guess how the government's going to accommodate that huge deficit just adds to that.
I think we've got time for one last question, but I thought you left halfway through, actually.
You came back.
I was actually going to, just to blow my nose in privacy, I'm sorry about that, but I stood at the back, so I wasn't away for long. This could be a limitation of Hayek's diagram. I just wanted to ask you about that, please. I'm from the University of London Philosophy Programme, for what it's worth.
I think he's heard that argument before.
Basically, isn't true consumption and perceived sustainability distorted by the manifest failure of current markets to account for long-term scarcity of naturally occurring commodities? And I mean, you can see that just in the fact that manufacturers very rarely have costed into their products the polluting effects of their products, and consumers very rarely have to pay. And consumers, the products themselves aren't priced accordingly, according to the pollution effects. So I wonder whether that's a kind of a long-term analysis, which isn't really being accounted for on the current markets.
Well, of course, that's an argument that's wholly foreign to both Keynes and Hayek. And I think markets do take into account those kinds of things, and certainly it's hard to make the argument that some other institutions could take them into account better. In other words, if the government stepped in and tried to somehow impose cost accounting that would count pollution this way or that way, it's not at all clear that that would be an improvement on the situation, okay? So markets aren't perfect. They work on the basis of what information there is as far as costs and benefits goes, and that would certainly be consistent with Hayek's view. And the failures that Keynes saw were something wholly apart from that. Okay, thank you.
Well, can I thank Professor Garrison for his nice, elegant lecture full of sound effects, and please give him a good round of applause. Thank you very much.